Welcome to the Gay News Podcast. This is episode 123. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the non-sectarian anarchistnews.org.
Editorial by Max Rez. Why is abortion the only issue where anarchists think charity is an appropriate and radical response? My partner asked me this question last month during the uproar around Alabama's recent attempt to outlaw the procedure. Why indeed? For all the talk of building capacity and material force, encroachments on the already near non-existent reproductive freedom experienced by most people have merited from most anarchists only fundraising efforts and calls for the defense of the same spaces that daily turn people away for lack of money. The absurdity of this position was on display during a recent episode of The Final Straw, where they interviewed the volunteer coordinator from the Carolina Abortion Fund, CAF. That this fund isn't anarchist in any sense of the term is evident given that their primary function is to provide partial financial support for abortion procedures. Money, by the way, that goes directly to clinics that charge hundreds of dollars or more for their services. Money is crucial here. It's the lifeblood of the fund and the clinics they give it to. And the episode even ends with our volunteer coordinator urging us to become a sustainer for as little as $5 a month, a call for donations that's echoed in Final Straw's description of the episode. What's radical about donating money, whether it be to a fund or to a clinic, to cover part of someone's procedure? How does this constitute autonomy in any but the most impoverished sense of the term, in which some limited freedom is purchased through charity? Why is this something that anarchists are taking an interest in and promoting when they could, say, be encouraging people to take matters into their own hands, a much more natural anarchist response, and even form support networks for the purpose of helping people perform or receive abortions outside of clinics? While the person from CAF makes some vague mentions of supporting self-management outside of clinics, this doesn't appear anywhere on the group's website and isn't taken up as a subject of conversation during the interview. Final Straw could perhaps be forgiven on account of the necessary secrecy supporting illegal activities, but for the fact that they aired a segment by Sean Swain at the beginning of the show asking when we were going to start killing the people in charge. Sean's argument is couched in the critique of actions that don't go far enough, protests, marches, rallies, etc., and thus don't achieve their goals. What a contrast to the rest of the episode. One of CAF's stated values is that income should not limit a person's ability to make reproductive decisions, yet they also acknowledge that they can't fund anyone's procedure in its entirety. The value of reproductive freedom becomes abstract. The spirit of the work, the same way that the spirit of freedom for Palestinians from Israeli occupation drives the protest marches that Sean is critiquing. In the end, it's a nice sounding concept from people whose practice falls totally short of achieving it. This isn't to single out Final Straw. In the wake of the Alabama kerfuffle, It's Going Down did something similar with their interview with Knoxville abortion doulas, whose discussion about self-management ultimately settled on an anecdote about one member wearing a shirt of instructions in order to, quote, push the conversation forward, unquote. Numerous people and groups joined liberals in raising money for Alabama's Yellowhammer Fund, which functions similarly to CAF. AK Press even put out some aesthetically displeasing abortion-themed shirts, sales of which contribute a whole $2 to the National Network of Abortion Funds, NNAF, of which the Yellowhammer Fund is a member. In addition to helping to coordinate partial funding of people's procedures to clinics, NNAF has the added bonus of providing things like professional development for its members. While it certainly can feel good to take action during an atmosphere of crisis, for whatever reason, when it comes to abortion, any critique of performative action, nonprofits, and charity appears to fly out the window. Though to their credit, Final Straw did mention the complications of critical engagement with the nonprofit industrial complex, a topic which was not picked up by the interviewee. Beyond the critique of charity itself, as opposed to mutual aid, the reactive defense of abortion that takes the form of supporting funds and defending clinics, which usually means defending Planned Parenthood, has also shown itself to be a losing one. Liberals have grown increasingly skeptical of the legal battle in which the Supreme Court acts as a stopgap to limit restrictive state laws, all the more since Trump's election and the bitter failure to stop Brett Kavanaugh's appointment to the Supreme Court. In such a pessimistic climate, the call for self-management has already entered polite discourse through liberals like Robin Marty, author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America, the Guttmacher Institute, see Self-Managed Medication Abortion, Expanding the Available Options for U.S. Abortion Care, and others. These are people and institutions already advocating or providing instructions for pill-induced abortions outside of clinics, and much like advocates for drug decriminalization, their vision of abortion is one in which the distribution of these pills still exists within a legal regime, able to be purchased at your nearest pharmacy and endowed with the legal protection of the state. Marty, beyond providing instructions, is even stumping for people to set up infrastructure now to prepare for a world in which Roe v. Wade has been overturned and the legal status of abortions has reverted back to states, a situation she perceives as a given within a decade. If this is how some liberals are talking, and mind you, the Guttmacher Institute isn't a radical outlier in the world of abortion, and Marty's book is being published by a major publisher, then what excuse do anarchists have for such a weak response? If you're going to do something, you need to push farther. Get educated about how to do it and the limits of the fund and clinic models for providing it. Demystifying abortion should help remove whatever mystique of radicalism these businesses and nonprofits enjoy and pull away the veil of medical specialization in which it's been cloaked. Go beyond the pill and learn about surgical procedures. If you want to do it for strangers, consider models like the Jane Collective and how that might look today. Marty's book might even be instructional here. Worth keeping in mind here is how the service model comes with its own barrel of worms. Let's avoid making nonprofits of our own and consider what mutual aid might look like. But if you shy away from serving the people, this could also just look like shared knowledge among a group of friends in case anyone should need it. And for fuck's sake, whatever you do, if you're going to donate money, at least try to find people doing something better than partially funding abortions. In the end, my complaint isn't really with CAAF, Knoxville Abortion Doulas, Yellowhammer, or NNAF. These are liberal groups operating as band-aids within capitalism and are, in their own limited ways, helping at least some people to attain a circumscribed reproductive freedom and in a way that looks a lot less weird or bad than some of the other funds and institutions out there. At least some of the people running them understand the limits of how abortion is practiced and funded today and appear to be looking beyond that. However furtively, though at least up to this point they've reconciled these qualms with their continued participation in that system and likely view their groups as part of the solution. But for all that, I have no expectations of them. My complaint is with anarchists who find these models interesting enough to engage with in their media outlets and, moreover, treat abortion as a charity event, which is to say as passive onlookers. If anarchists should say what only anarchists can, then we should think of more interesting things to say than urging people to donate, especially when we have good examples like Sean Swain amongst us doing otherwise.
What's new this week? Anarchists storm polling station and burn ballot box in Athens, from the Greek Reporter. A very brief mainstream note. Quote, a group of 10 self-styled anarchists stormed a polling station in Exarchia, the infamous neighborhood of Athens, stole a ballot box and set it on fire a few minutes before the voting ended for the general elections. The perpetrators used a sledgehammer to threaten electoral clerks before grabbing the ballot box and making off with it. According to Greek electoral law, the voting at the polling station will be repeated next Sunday, unquote. A fun and unusual anti-voting action, the Greeks amp up the action level yet again.
Anarchy among anarchists as anti-capitalist clubhouse listed for sale, from The Age, an Australian mainstream media site. Okay, mainstream media sucks, and anarchists getting their pictures in it is probably a bad idea. But the particular sequence of photos in this story is endearing, tragic, and funny. The story is about infighting over a 30-year-old anarchist space, and that's as far as I trust the mainstream media slash any outsider to understand what is going on. There are two sides to the fight, apparently, and both claim legitimacy. Moving on. But the photos! The first one is a sparse lineup with one awkward outsider-looking kid, a clump of cooler kids, including a couple who are hiding their faces, and a sign saying, not for sale. an absolutely classic image, followed by the same scene from a different angle, so it includes a besuited real estate agent grimacing at the camera, and also a white dog in a pink shirt. Really, nothing more needed to be said. This is not to downplay the significance of struggles over spaces, especially spaces that have been around for more than a minute.
Sacrificing life. What did Mikhail Zlobitsky achieve? From Abolition Media Worldwide English. This piece from AMW English is a remembrance and celebration of the Russian who responded to anarchists being rounded up and tortured by suicide bombing a Russian state office. This piece is unfortunately Nechevian, by which I mean that it takes a simplistic view of martyrdom. Anyone who doesn't sympathize with and respect Mikhail's act is a fucking idiot. But to reflect on it appropriately requires more than some paragraphs saying self-sacrifice is good, revolutionary sacrifice for the future good. That said, this is a worthwhile reminder of Mikhail's act. It is always worth remembering that we, those of us who have not yet blown ourselves up in an act of resistance, are still sacrificing important things every moment of every day. And to the extent that this piece addresses condemnation of Zlobitsky, which could be happening more among the people who knew him, it is valuable for that as well. Quote, yes, thoughts about death are terrible. Moreover, anarchism is not historically religious, so most of us do not expect paradise after death. In addition, some of our contemporaries like to present anarchism as an exceptionally peaceful worldview. The task of anarchism is to achieve a free and fair life. However, this is often falsely mixed with a desire for a comfortable, trouble-free life in utopia, on the way to which it is desirable to avoid any kind of suffering. This is a fatal distortion. Being applied to anarchism, it completely deprives anarchism of its heroic adversary spirit, which is an integral part of its essence. Unquote.
Interview with anarchists from Caucasus about the political situation in Caucasus region. From Prement, a site that brought some of the most thorough of the reporting on the state torture of Russian area anarchists. Maybe this is another function of getting older, but reading this interview, which is only about the political situation in Caucasus region in the most shallow possible way, reminded me of too many people in my past. It also made me wonder if either the interviewee or the interviewer were a mole. But probably this is an issue with a class of interviews more than anything else. Long story short, this interview has nothing interesting to say about anarchism, but there is something perhaps worth noting about what people in the area think about Russia and also what they are familiar with regarding US practices. Quote, what are your views about Russian occupation? I'm totally against Russian occupation, not because I support idea of state. No, I'm against Russian imperialism. Russia is nowadays fascist state. Russian Empire are doing same thing in Caucasus like Erdogan's Turkey are doing in Kurdistan or America in Puerto Rico, unquote.
Fuck the parole board, fuck hate crime policy, and as always, fuck the police. From Anon. This provides more background info to the re-arrest and incarceration of Cedar, and the hate crimes the city is supposedly responding to, but really to the point that police are not here to help us, which highlights that this article is not for anarchists, despite the very anarchist-friendly title. It seems to be aimed at the people who were up in figurative arms about the Pride fiasco, but are probably now back in their resignation or acceptance bubble. That's a totally valid target audience, of course. Quote, all those who have joined the chorus of outrage in the wake of the attack on this year's Pride and the subsequent mishandling of the situation by City Hall and the Hamilton Police Services should refuse to be pacified. Promises of more surveillance and repression from the very same people who have long refused to keep queers, trans, and non-binary folks safe and criminalize those who stepped up to do so is absolutely against our collective interests. Unquote.
A report back from a demo in the village, from Montreal, counter-info by Anon. This is a really worthwhile report back and critique and reminder about some important things. The report back is for a protest against how some queer anarchist prisoners, including Cedar, are being treated. The critique is about the logistics of doing protests in different areas and what that requires. Quote, Cedar and perhaps one or both of the other prisoners could be in jail for a while. There could be future arrests too, or other consequences that may not be publicized as much. This demands that we keep finding the time to talk about the situation, to make sure we know what our friends need and want from us, and to reflect on whether our own practices are succeeding as we want them to. Our solidarity needs to be serious and sustained, not just spectacular. It needs to improve our own capabilities too, and we all knew that already, but reminders can be nice, unquote. The reminders are about things like not making heroes or centralizing figures out of sympathetic state victims, as that both increases the risk to them and is counter to anarchist ethics. I don't disagree with any of this, obviously, but it's also true that there are things that it doesn't fully grapple with. For example, when you're playing a PR game, which activism is, maybe even by definition, one doesn't get to say no heroes. A specific face is required, because that's what people respond to, individuals rather than amorphous crowds. That doesn't deny that it's not anarchist, which is where the conundrum comes in. Anyway, very interesting questions are raised in this piece, even if it was published later than it should have been.
North Texas to host first anarchist book fair. An announcement of a book fair with a lineup of speakers, workshops, and vendors that features plenty of non-anarchist projects and people, including someone who ran for president, albeit as a joke, apparently. Not as funny as Sean Swain running for office or doing anything else, so whatever.
The book Venezuelan Anarchism, The History of a Movement is now available in English from El Libertario. Quote, an independent and autonomous anarchist newspaper from the city of Caracas since 1995, unquote. It's a history of anarchism in Venezuela by a lawyer, historian, activist, who has written for anarchist periodicals, including El Libertario. Now in English. Perhaps someone will read it and give us a report, or better yet, a review.
Call for week of agitation for Miguel Peralta from It's Going Down. Mexican anarchist falsely accused of homicide is getting fucked with by the court system. Quote, for over 4 years that Miguel has been incarcerated, it has been demonstrated on countless occasions that the accusations against him are fabricated. The absurdity is ever clearer with the same courts, tribunal in Oaxaca and court in Huatla, having cast aside the same criminal case for being inconsistent and contradictory, resulting in freedom of 7 other political prisoners from Aloxichitlan, unquote. This is a call for a week of action from July 22nd to the 28th to repudiate prisons and show solidarity from our own spaces and in our own chosen forms. Includes an email address to send info about what you do.
The Anarchical Optical and the Role of Anarchics in the World War from A Infos. As indicated by the title, this seems to be a very awkward translation of an article discussing the significance of anarchism on World War I. Optical is never explained or defined, nor is the use of anarchics. Quote, in all major conflicts, ideology plays an important role. The same is true in the case of the First World War, where various competing ideological trends, communism, nationalism, etc., collided with each other. At that time, anarchism was also a very powerful and massive movement that in some countries even overshadowed the Marxist and other left-wing movements. Such a dynamic movement could not have affected the war-related developments and especially the revolutionary processes that this war caused, unquote. Surely that should have read, must have affected or could not have helped affecting? The copy editor is disturbed. At any rate, this piece will probably be interesting reading for folks of a historical bent, or those who think that significant things from that time are reproducible somehow.
Anarchists put picnic tables in park, from the Lansing State Journal. City provides tables in a park, then removes them. Anarchist project helping homeless people replaces the tables and chains them to a tree. City decides not to remove them yet. So many ways to reject the state and capitalism.
Merge to Excel, from A Infos. A brief and confusing editorial from the periodical Alternative Libertaire announcing the breakup of a joint project with the group Libertarian Alternative and the coordination of anarchist groups in which they were planning on doing something together and were figuring out what that something would be? You could read this announcement as an intriguing mashup of translation, poetry, and puzzle with lots of replay potential.
The Attack on Women's Rights, a presentation by Miriam Pickens from the 1st of May Anarchist Alliance. A radical feminist, not a trans-exclusionary one though, explains how important access to abortion is. Like too many feminists who tack on the anarcha, this doesn't address the contradiction of insisting on rights from the state rather than encouraging us to meet our own needs. She cites the horror shows of illegal abortions, they were definitely mostly horrible, with no mention of people taking our own health into our own hands, as demonstrated by one of my favorite projects, Jane, for example. This is the closing paragraph. Quote, to bring it back to anarchism, we propose community self-defense as the form the resistance should take. In our communities, our schools, our workplaces, our parks, all of our social space must be defended and protected from the capitalist and predator onslaught. Every protection we have ever had in our entire history of struggle has been what we have provided for ourselves. We must organize to resist, opening our communication with each other so we can figure out our best tactics and strategies. These organizations are posed defensively, yet they lay the basis and provide a form for a revolutionary overthrow of the entire system. There must be a revolution because they will smash us until we smash them, unquote. Our schools? Our workplaces? What the fuck?
Anarchist comrade Nikos Romanos released from prison in Greece. From RFA.
Woohoo!
Romanos is out after roughly half his sentence, and apparently used his time to good effect, finishing high school, two kinds of prison time served at once, excellent multitasking, and so on. This announcement quotes Romanos from earlier this year promoting, quote, real danger for every ruler, unquote. Good for him for getting out and standing strong.
Audio and video. Anarchy Bang, introducing episode 28, Terrorism. 2 hours. Quote, this week we will be discussing terrorism. Terrorism is the threat or use of violence in the pursuit of political goals. Obviously, states use terrorism all the time to control and put fear in their constituent populations. The border situation terrifies both the people crossing the border and anyone living within range of ICE policing, border asylum camps, or the militarized border itself. This week, we will be discussing anarchist views of terror, Adam Curtis's Power of Nightmares that links the 19th century and 20th century views on terror. We'll discuss how the 21st century continues in this vein and how anarchists should confound politics of terror, but end up being a kind of booster for statist terror itself. Join in the conversation, unquote. Also, scary fucking image for this story. Ew.
Anarchy Radio, an hour. Jay-Z and Kathan co-host. Two calls. Tim of the Whitaker Tales calls in to talk about an article they skimmed concerning what sounds like some kind of new surveillance zeppelin, I think? Kathan remarks, I am hoping sarcastically, but perhaps I'm an optimist, that they should get the Whitaker neighborhood put on the National Register of Historic Places. Second caller, the lovable troll Alfredo of Occupied Southwest Distro, is deflected with a soft, grandparently hand. Also technology bad.
Topic of the week. Civ or anti-civ, and models for behavior. What is the ratio here of civ to anti-civ folks? What are you, dear reader? What does civilization mean to you, and what does anti-civ mean? And a different but related question, what model do you base a better human world on? Ants? Bees? Plants? Bacteria? Better humans than the ones who surround you? Software? Programmers? What actual interactions that exist in the world do you think give a good picture of what people, / anarchists, could or would do with each other in a better world? Hello, Ariel.
Hello, Aragorn.
What are your thoughts?
The question makes me wonder something that I don't think I've wondered before. Do you think that there are a substantial number of anarchists who would say that they are pro civilization without caveats? Like, I think there are people who are going to make the argument for modern medical care. Well, and I don't know what else, but yeah, it seems like just a straight up pro civilization anarchist
that's not true. I'm thinking about my life and people I've known.
No. Okay. No, that's not true. Never mind. I take all that back. I remember being in New York and organizing the book fair, and some anti-civ or primitivist anarchists wanting to do a workshop. And most of the committee saying no, because that was an anarchist. So it's all coming back now.
Yes. It's actually worth mentioning that there are certain sort of ideas or processes that are more popular in different parts of the country than others.
Right.
When we talk about asking the question about whether or not civilization matters, that's a West Coast anarchist perspective.
Yep.
And I think it's sort of worth reflecting on the fact that anarchism is a regional phenomenon, and that anarchists on the East Coast, especially a place like New York City, sort of has a different set of priorities
right.
than anarchists on the West Coast. you know, I mean, famously, Wayne Price lives in the New York New York area, and his kind of anarchism does not ask the question of whether or not civilization is interesting, because he assumes that it is.
Right.
It is worth mentioning sort of the similarities that aren't mentioned in this. By the way, this is this topic of the week cracks me up because, you know, each of the people that write these topic of the weeks have different styles. Mm-hmm. And this particular author's style is to barrage with questions. and I'm not sure, you know, like they of course are like behind the curtain of this barrage of questions. It's sort of an interesting style to me. Anyways, you know, this topic of the week assumes that the author has no position at all. But of course, this is clearly a West Coast author who, in fact, does think that the question of civilization is a question worth answering.
Right.
There are a lot of positions that are pro-civ. I mean, you know, one of the biggest conflicts, and on some level, the reason why this conflict exists is because conceptually, it's sort of in the same space, even if stylistically it seems so different. But transhumanism,
right,
fundamentally assumes civilization and all the things that sort of like an anti-civilization anarchist would critique. And to put my own cards on the table, you know, I've moved to the West Coast for a variety of reasons, one of which is that sort of like this sensibility is my sensibility. I like asking and wrestling with big questions more than I like getting down to brass tacks and solving questions, because I don't actually see that all the people that want to get down to brass tacks and solve questions are solving anything at all. They're just asking questions in a different sort of phase, and would rather live in a different phase of what that looks like. So in fact, I don't think that someone who thinks that asking the question whether or not civilization is something we should be opposed to is any closer to resolving the conflicts than someone who does think that that's an important question. Anyway, so I've been, you know, associated with the anti-civilization perspective for a long time, but I, in fact, am much more interested in framing the question in terms of how did the people who lived in the United States prior to colonization answer these questions? How do they live mm-hmm. in ways that sort of vindicate this behavior or that speak to this behavior? And what would it look like for us to return to that way of life? Although all that said, you know, I really feel like we should be talking a lot more about damages done and what would the world look like if we stop civilization tomorrow.
Yep.
To me, you know, that's the more relevant question in terms of like what I do with my life. And I've always said, you know, and I rarely get asked this question, but like, what would I do after the revolution? I'd sit under a tree all the time and hang out with people. What would you do?
I have a very different relationship to questions like this than I did when I was younger. My response to this is, whether or not I am pro-civilization or anti-civilization, and what I think civilization means and what I think it means, or what I think it means to live a life of anti-civilization, doesn't really matter that much. So civilization and the world of civilization and technology is the one that we live in. It's the hand that we've been dealt. It's what we have to deal with. And, you know, if we were fortunate enough to see its collapse, then we would have to deal with the aftermath of that, which would be a massive pain in the ass. And while I think, you know, lives can probably be carved out in its ruins, it's still... This is the world that we live in.
Just as a funny vignette, someone who lives in our house has moved from attaching themselves to one network versus the other in the two internal networks that exist in our household.
Uh-huh.
And they literally were like complaining to me about how terrible the new network that they're on is compared to the old network that they were on. This would be an example of how challenging destroying civilization would be.
Well, I had a conversation. I think my little sister overheard a conversation that I was having with other people about it. And then she came to me later to clarify it. And so one of the questions I asked her was about, you know, learning how to do things that you don't know how to do. And her response to me was, well, but that's that you can just find videos on YouTube. And I was like, no, you don't understand. There are no phones. There is no internet. There is no YouTube. And she was just done with the conversation. I mean, to her, I think she was
17.
19, 18 at the time. But that was more than she could possibly fathom on any level. And she just walked away from me. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, what model do you base a better human world on? I think any of these would be great. Ants, bees, plants, bacteria. I don't know. Bacteria can be kind of scary. Better humans than the ones who surround you. I don't know. I think I'm mostly surrounded by pretty good humans. I think when humans are at our best, we take pretty good care of ourselves and each other. I liked my father's family comes from a very small Midwestern town where basically all the Black people lived on the same side of town. And everybody was Black and poor in a town that, you know, kind of still thought it was 1960-something. And everybody took care of each other. And kind of for the most part, like, you couldn't be bad in the street and act out four streets over from your house because you didn't trouble when you came home because somebody would call you. But at the same time,
no telephones,
people didn't go hungry and like the crime rate was really low in that part of town because people didn't, you know, everybody was always watching and paying attention. And so this was just,
I mean, this is actually,
let me finish it. It's kind of a little more urban, less intentional version of maybe a Quaker community or a Mennonite community. Sure. But these kind of communities this is what, you know, people who don't have access to everything, which perhaps this is a scenario that we're talking about, but for different reasons, figuring out how to make a life with what they have and taking care of each other in the process. And that's, I'm trying in very good faith to answer the questions here. And those are, I think, really good, you know, modern, right now, real world examples of what we could do with each other in a better world. Although I know the neighborhood example is a lot rarer now.
Yes.
Because it seems that mostly people don't know their neighbors anymore.
I mean, to be blunt in terms of answering the question, I think that all the information that we need about how to live in this world, we can find by rediscovering our connection to pre-contact North American peoples. But to answer this question in the social environment that we currently live in the anarchist space, I think a lot of people like to answer this question as if they lived in a purely science fiction universe where the context of this question is created by us rather than there be hundreds of years of context that you have to fucking cleave your way through,
right,
or use anthropologists to sort of teach you about. And so this science fiction mechanism, you know, there's obviously two sort of directions. One would be the sort of transhumanist direction that we sort of nodded at, but then passed by. And I will continue to do that because I mostly hate those people. But they do ask some seriously interesting questions. But because they don't pay attention to the memory of human context, I think that they do some terrible Western civilization sort of behaviors.
Okay.
And then the second option, you know, which obviously we talk about all the time because we talk about anarcho-primitivism and sort of the factions that sort of identify that themselves in that direction, you know, they do play a kind of game with what they know because of anthropology about prior forms of human behavior. But then they do the same thing, in my opinion, that the transhumanists do, which is they sort of then strip away the human context of why those people did the things that they did in the first place, rather than, and they pretend like people made decisions based on like like rational intellectual exercises.
Oh, okay.
And I in fact think that's not how people work.
No.
Right? That human culture is sort of the language that we use to talk about the slow way in which people change.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one thing that if tomorrow civilization were to be destroyed either because of alien intervention or humans fucking themselves over, whatever that new world that we would wake up in would not be the new world of having completed a series of questions like this is presenting us with. It instead would be us figuring out how it is that we are going to move the context that we sort of come into this discussion with, how we would move that forward. So, you know, one of the first questions would be, if civilization ended tomorrow, is, are we going to begin a new world with the friends that we have in the town that we live in?
Right.
Or are we going to begin the new world by reaching out to some community of like-minded people who want to come here or something like that? Like, these are really big questions, and they're questions more of like, how do you answer the question about space, resources, mechanisms like feeding ourselves, and how do we do it based on anarchist decisions that we've been living with for decades? Even in thinking about my home, you know, there's about 10 anarchists that live here. Well, what does it mean to change our relationship, which mostly is sort of as individuated people, and start to have to solve our problems together? Like, that would be a huge conversation. Would take us weeks or months to even start to approach an answer to it, because we don't know how to do that. We've never done it before. We are individuated people. And, you know, and so I guess the short and the long answer to me is that, like, I don't know the answer to these questions.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was kind of the point that I was going from, that I was trying to make. And not only do I not know the answer to the questions, I cannot reasonably conceive of the context in which these questions have to be answered. I mean, I like science fiction, so my head, and I like dystopias, so my head is full of images from movies and novels, and that's kind of the best that I have.
Yeah, Mad Max.
And... you know, there's no possible way to begin to talk about how wrong any of that is. And I'm probably really wrong about the things that I think are the most right about it. And there's no way to know. So, I don't know. What am I saying? I guess I'm saying, have a plan, but be willing to let go of your plan.
Don't hold on to it tightly.
Know that your plan's probably shit. and go with it, I guess. And maybe the life that I get to have will be better than this one.
Thank you very much.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Greg. What's New was written by Jackie and Greg and read by Chisel and Greg. The editorial was written by Max Rez and read by Greg. We thank Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org and or the Anarchist News IRC chat room, which is linked on anarchistnews.org, and anarchy101.org.
Your admission that you feel the same, I'll have reached the goal I'm dreaming of. Believe me, I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart.
I don't want to set the world on.